Y'all give us a couple of minutes to switch gears.
You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Isla Earth. In April of 1990, biologist David Jude pulled a little bug-eyed fish from the St. Clair River near Detroit. It was a round goby. Immediately, alarm bells went off in Jude's head. What was a goby doing here? This was North America, not the Black Sea where the species belonged. Jude knew the goby well, and he knew the local ecosystem was in for a shock. This was a fish with a reputation as a street fighter, one that was willing to defend its turf and nests against fish twice its size. That tough guy stance serves the goby well where it came from in the Black Sea, but in the Great Lakes, it could only mean trouble for the locals. Now, thanks to this forceful invader, the mottled sculpin, greenside darter, and the log perch have largely disappeared. And these aren't the only species in trouble. The goby's aggressive nature is matched only by a supersized appetite for the eggs of the smallmouth bass, walleye, and perch. Yet a mystery remained. How did the round goby get here? And what to do now that they're here? Learn more about invasive species at islaearth.org. Isla Earth is recorded on the campus of California State University, San Bernardino, and produced by the Catalina Island Conservancy, because Earth is an island.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Fellow Americans.
He's been sick. And I think his wife is going to bring him some chicken soup. It's hard to defend an unpopular policy every once in a while.
Plastic people, oh baby, now you're such a drag.
And there's this guy from the CIA and he's creeping around Laurel Canyon.
Get tired of you, honey. It's your hairspray or something.
Plastic people, oh baby, you're such a drag.
I hear the sound of marching feet down Sunset Boulevard to Crescent Heights, and there at Pandora's Box, we are confronted with a vast quantity of plastic people.
Take a day and walk around, watch the Nazis run your town, then go home and check yourself. You think we're singing about someone else,
but you're plastic people. Oh, baby, now you're such a drag.
Love will never be.
Made the decision we're going to war with Iraq. This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, we're going to war with Iraq. Why? He said, I don't know. He said, I guess they don't know what else to do. So I said, well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda? He said, no, no. He says, there's nothing new that way. They've just made the decision to go to war with Iraq. He said, I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments. And he said, I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail. So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran. The truth is about the Middle East is, had there been no oil there, and there's no question that the presence of petroleum throughout the region has sparked great power involvement. Whether that was the specific motivation for the coup or not, I can't tell you, but there was definitely, there's always been this attitude that somehow we could intervene and use force in the region.
To keep the military-industrial complex going, it means industry devoted to making equipment for the military. Planes, uniforms, bridges, boots. I mean, it's vast, the amount of equipment that it takes to maintain an army. The bombs, of course, they really have no value. I mean, until you drop them, and what do they then do? They destroy things, which then gives you the opportunity to rebuild them. So we have military contractors, among them Dick Cheney's old company, Halliburton, that is, after we have managed to turn large parts of Iraq or Vietnam into rubble, to reconstructing the roads or maintaining the local military, the local police services. In Afghanistan at the moment, I think we have 60,000 troops, but we also have at least that many, 60,000 private contractors, being paid more money than the soldiers to do the same kind of things. Our diplomats in Iraq are guarded by private contractors. You're paying those salaries, you're keeping those people on contract.
Do you think we'd been in Iraq if they didn't move, sitting on the world's second largest oil reserve? You'd think we'd be in Libya if they didn't have the sweet crude oil, one of the finest in the world? How come we're not in Yemen? They're killing more people there every day than Gaddafi ever did. It's costing trillions of dollars, but the cost is even greater than that. It's all the people that have been killed on both sides, a whole country destroyed. People losing their limbs and lives and livelihoods and futures for what? For a big lie.
Only an alert and knowledgeable citizen.
They're a bunch of criminals. They're a bunch of criminals. They've taken over our government. He who makes the money makes the rules. And because these guys make the money, they control our government, both the Democrats and the Republicans. And it doesn't matter whether Hillary Clinton's in office or George Bush is in office, the same things are going to happen. There are minor differences, but essentially the same thing is going to happen. Well, you should be frightened, because these people are controlling our lives. You know, we're no longer in charge of our own lives. Everything, we did not go to Iraq to bring freedom to Iraq. We're in Iraq, and we keep talking about promoting democracy. What we're promoting is a one world government, a new world order. When they use the word democracy, just take that word democracy out and put in new world order, one world order, globalization. Put in any of those words in place of democracy. That's what it's about. He told me that they really want to do is have a one-world government without borders, right? And have everybody on this earth implanted with an RFID chip.
Do you believe that?
I know that. Didn't you hear the congressman, the senator, asking the Supreme Court justice how he's going to rule on that in my clip? You think he asked them for no reason? They're already implanting people with chips. The national ID card, which becomes law by May 2008, it's going to have an RFID chip in it. Okay, everything is done in stages. After the RFID chip goes in the card and in your passport, it's going to go into your body. That's what they're going to try and do. There's no question about it. And they're not going to do it through law. They're going to do it because you won't be able to live without it. All your money is going to be in that chip. I think Waco is my tipping point. When I saw what happened to Waco, I said, I'm going full-fledged. This is disgusting. They killed all those people for no reason. There was no need for those people to die and to be killed in that fire and burned to death. That was the most disgusting event. The war in Iraq. A disgusting event. When I heard Rumsfeld talking about shock and awe, oh, let's everybody go home, watch on television, shock and awe, as if it was a 4th of July fireworks. There are people under that concrete being killed and maimed, children and women and men dying for no reason. Aaron, you get it? And that's how this country is working. It's run by evil. It's run by evil forces. And people in this country better wake up to the truth and save this country from what's happening.
Now this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our societies. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
I don't think this is a religious war. I think this is a war between evil people that are willing to kill on a mass scale, people that would like to end up with weapons of mass destruction and even kill more than they did in New York City. And what I'm saying is a truth. And the truth is people yearn to be free, no matter who they are or what their religion is.
Welcome back to the Real News Network and our series of interviews with Larry Korb. Larry is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and was an assistant defense secretary under Reagan. Thanks, Larry. So Eisenhower warned us. He said, beware of the military-industrial complex that the American economy and the American government have become so enmeshed in this military productive sector. And just for full disclosure, I think you worked for a while with Raytheon, which is
Raytheon. Sort of, yeah, Raytheon. I got fired after a couple of months for speaking out about some of these issues. Right.
Well, that's to your merit, in my opinion. In two ways, doesn't Obama, if he wants to fulfill the promise of real change, have to take on the military-industrial complex in some form or another? And for two reasons. Number one, because all the stimulus has to get paid for. There's going to be enormous push of putting money into the domestic economy. And you can't just print it. And the obvious place where money could come from is out of this industrial military sector. But maybe even more importantly, so much of the foreign policy assumptions are based on this premise that America must have military supremacy and hegemony. And sometimes the word leadership gets used, but there's a difference between leadership and hegemony. And most of the world see this, hundreds of military bases and aircraft carriers all over the world. I mean, is there any way, should Obama start to try to unravel some of this, and do you think he's in any position to do it?
Well, I think he can do it in two ways, one of which, and even the Pentagon will support him on this, is not make military the first option to every problem and allow the military to solve problems that should be solved by agencies like the Agency for International Development. And the way you do that is you plus up their budgets and you stop the growth in defense spending. Defense spending in real terms, and I'm not talking about the war, the war costs, have gone up over the last decade about 40% in real terms. In real terms, real dollars now, we're spending more at the height of the Reagan buildup, which was theoretically to bring the Soviet Union, a major superpower, to its knees. And the way you do that is that you stop building weapons that deal with threats from a bygone era. Secretary Gates, who has been kept on, has said he wants to stop the F-22, this new generation fighter. The Air Force has about 183. They'd like 380. And he has said, and I think quite remarkably, how many are you using of these against these insurgent groups that we're fighting? I think he has to follow through on that. The Navy is running into trouble with a ship called the DDG-1000, which is a destroyer built to fight open ocean warfare. We haven't had any of that since World War II. Stop production of those things. And I think that...
And there's a new round, at least there was under Bush, a new round of nuclear weapons plan.
Well, there was. And I think Obama has said, and one of the things that attracted me to him, that he wants to cut down nuclear weapons and eliminate them if they can. And let me tell you something. If you were to take our nuclear arsenal and say, look, we're going to go down to 1,000 right now, 600 operational, 400 in reserve, you'd have support of a lot of military leaders, and you would save you about $20 billion a year, and you would also enhance America's ability to stop proliferation in, you know, countries we would like to stop from getting nuclear weapons.
Should Obama, and is there any reason why America has to be the military supreme in the world? Can you start to question some of these assumptions? Can the United States be more of one of many countries? Does it have to have, I think it's over 1,000 military bases?
Well, I think what the United States has to do is have a military that supports its interests. The problem with the Bush approach was that we have to be military dominant, regardless. Well, what's your purpose of it? And what Pentagon has talked about, we're building capabilities. Capabilities for what? The first thing you got to do is have a national security strategy. Now, if you read Bush's national security strategy, it was based on the doctrine, not of preemption, preventive war, which says the United States reserves the right to use military force against any nation that it thinks could be a threat to it. And that was a justification for going into Iraq. So you go back to the doctrine of, you know, preemption, if somebody's about to attack you, but, you know, using military power to further political ends, to deal with real threats. I think once you do that, then you'll undermine the basis for the military-industrial complex. Because if my goal is dominance, I can justify building anything. I mean, if I want to be dominant, I got to stay ahead of everybody. Why not, you know, build this?
And can Obama do that?
I think he can.
Can he afford to do it politically in terms of American politics? But one would think Americans are ready for such a thing now.
Well, I think he can do it. And one of the reasons I hope that he kept Secretary Gates on, it'll be easier for Secretary Gates, having been appointed by a Republican president and worked for two Republican presidents, to go and do this. After all, when Secretary Gates said, you know, I think we got enough F-22s, the Bush administration wouldn't let him close down the production line. So Obama can let him close down the production line.
Because we haven't, because so far, at least in the election campaign, although we've heard Obama promise or say we need a new mindset, I don't think we've heard a new mindset. When during the Georgia-Russia conflict, which I think most people now recognize that Saakashvili kind of started it with a provocation in South Ossetia, we saw during the campaign, McCain says, I looked in Putin's eyes and I see KGB. But Obama said, well, maybe they're not the evil empire, but I see them doing evil. Mm-hmm. This encirclement of Russia, the push towards getting Ukraine, Georgia into NATO, missiles in Poland, radar in Czech Republic. Do you think Obama should put a stop to that kind of
thing? Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because after the election, then-President-elect Obama spoke to the Polish Prime Minister, and he came out and said, oh, he's supporting putting the missiles and the radars in Eastern Europe. And Obama spoke and said, no, he's not. And I suspect what you're going to see is they're going to take another look at that, and they'll basically slow walk it and say, well, of course, we want to do this eventually, but, you know, the system's not ready now. Funds are tight, and Congress, you know, will not appropriate the money. In the same way with Georgia and Ukraine, the expansion of NATO, say, well, eventually we'd like to, you know, do it, but it's not a big issue. I mean, Bush forced it on the agenda at NATO. This was not something the alliance was looking for. So you pull back and you do it in such a way that you send the right signal to the Russians. Because we've got big interests with the Russians. Helping Iran, we need their help to put sanctions on Iran, to get Iran to stop their nuclear development. And the other is we need their help in reducing the number of nuclear weapons in the world. That's our two main interests. You should not let putting, you know, a system in Eastern Europe or expanding NATO at this time interfere.
So if the objective shouldn't be dominance, should there then be sometimes in this next phase, four-year phase, a major cut to the military budget?
Well,
is there any indication that
the first thing you're going to do is basically going to not keep up this almost double-digit growth each year. And the second thing is that you will use the military as a stimulus, but not to buy weapon systems, to do military construction, family housing, fix up your bases, improve the living, and put the money that you were going to spend, say, in 2011, 12, or 13, spend it in 2010. That will be the emphasis, rather than, oh, gee, we need to build a fighter plane or a bomber that we don't need. Let me tell you, this administration that just left office has been led to the most poorly managed Pentagon I've ever seen. I've been studying this for 40 years. I mean, the cost growth in the weapon systems, it just unbelievable. And they've got to bring that under control and manage the Pentagon, you know, better.
And you campaigned for Obama. Now you can kind of step back. He's been elected. You're not going to, it doesn't look like you're going to get a job there right away. If you had to put a bar, a litmus test, that we have a new foreign policy here, or it's same old, what will be the test of that?
I think the first thing is whether he follows through on his campaign promise to start taking the combat troops out of Iraq within 16 months. I think that's going to be a very, very key, you know, key indicator. And then the other thing is whether he'll review, and as he said in the campaign, all of the weapon systems on the Pentagon drawing board to see, you know, what we should go ahead.
And should he open up talks with Iran?
Oh, I think very definitely. You're going to have to talk to Iran eventually. And that's one of the things that attracted me to him, the fact that he recognized you've got to talk to your enemies. I mean, this idea that somehow, and it reminded me as we were talking earlier here about President Reagan, when he started talking to Gorbachev, people like Newt Gingrich went on to become Speaker of the House, called him Neville Chamberlain. I'm thinking, you got to talk to the Soviets. Nixon, Johnson, Kennedy, we all talk. Not that we like them, but you have to negotiate with them.
Thanks very much, Larry.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us on the Real News Network.
28 minutes after the hour of midnight, right here on Community Radio in the 21st century. I am Benjamin, your host of the program. Here it is, Paragon Radio. Paragon because it's perfect and it's ideal. 816-931-5534 is the telephone number to the on-air studio. The non-corporately sponsored text line is 301-5731, 816-301-5731. As we enter into another season of grilling, right? Yeah, barbecue day. Memorial Day weekend. Another example of a celebration of American culture and history. Future. Why not? Let's celebrate the future, too. If we're celebrating the past, if we're remembering the war dead on Memorial Day and the other dead, too, let's remember the future as well, because if we have fought conflict in the past, there is no doubt that the conflicts of the future are near. They are close at hand. None of the conflicts of the past have mediated the warfare of the future. They used to fight wars, to end all wars. But let's be honest. The war that would end all wars would be the war that ended all of this. Human beings, it's who we are. We are creatures who are extremely social and interdependent upon other human beings. And we are also very territorial and defensive. We do not like people who are unlike us. We do not like people who are different. Differences can really, really put us on the defensive and cause us to be very violent. Very, very violent. And these differences persist, and they're in many different ways. I could be talking about cultural differences. I could be talking about political differences, economic differences. We you know, in the last month, because of that old crusty guy in LA who owns a kind of basketball team, making comments privately that got turned into public humiliation and shame for him, we were talking about race, black people and white people, and the differences, the cultural differences that exist. People that transcend those cultures, people that become very defensive over those cultures. Now, it's a perfect example of where the friction and tension of human beings originate. The differences that we have with each other. Now, we the people in this country that is kind of democratic and kind of republic and kind of imperial and kind of oligarchic and kind of plutocratic, we're kind of a lot of things here in America. There is no doubt about that. But in this country, where the will of the people does play a role in the governance of the land, it's true, it does play a role. Does it play the only role? Is the will of the people the only force within the political reality of America? Absolutely not. The will of the corporation, the will of the money, the will of the military-industrial complex is probably collectively more important than the will of the people because of our inability to effectively exercise our political bloc, our political power. We find ourselves heavily diluted by money. Our ideas and concepts in many ways are just delusions and regurgitations of somebody else's ideas. Talking about how some of these Tea Party politicians who are in Washington have a very hard time formulating ideas extemporaneously, have an issue coming up with answers to questions off the top of their head. Because those politicians who became office holders based upon super PAC money, Coke money, whatever kind of astroturfed Freedom Works Tea Party reality it is, they were never put to the test as politicians maybe traditionally are, where they have to go out and fundraise on their own. Probably the biggest challenge to being a politician is the fundraising. You have to go raise big bucks so you can pay for yard signs and commercial advertisements and run a political campaign office. So you can either go out and do the hard, nitty-gritty work of testing your policy and platform with the people, getting them to respond to you with money, or you can just follow somebody else's policy or platform, and then they write the check for you. It's very easy like that. It's the way the political system has evolved or devolved in this country. Money has always played a big role in politics. Now it's like there is a kit that you can order from the Tea Party that comes replete with campaign contributions to run for political office. Your entire platform, the issues you are supposed to make your hallmark while in office, all come prepackaged and ready to go. No need to cook or chop or clean, just add water, and one political reality comes to life. That interest is very powerful. The people's will still plays a role. It is becoming smaller and smaller because of the levels of dysfunction that we have in organizing that. And, you know, hey, the Tea Party, what they had a terrible defeat last election, last Tuesday, in a lot of state primaries, in 6 or 7 state primaries. They were completely shut out. Because people in America generally are not extreme. People in America are generally going to appeal to the center. We're a center country. Very balanced country in that respect. But just because the Tea Party was defeated in Republican primaries over the last week, in the last week, does not mean that the massive amounts of money that put people into power under the banner of the Tea Party is not still going to be heavily influencing the electoral process, the election, in this midterm election cycle. People still have a voice. The political elite, the folks that actually control the structures of government, that moneyed power on this Memorial Day, let us remember that without their military-industrial complex, the United States would be nothing like it is today. And that we have essentially been in a perpetual state of war since World War II. It has been the function of the government to write checks and run deficits for the purposes of maintaining that military-industrial complex, of maintaining a Keynesian defense spending policy, i.e. deficit spending, i.e. spending the money that you don't have, which makes a stimulus to the economy. I mean, it is so much a part of the economy. And once those corporations are heavily funded to build weapons and machines of war, to outfit, clothe, and now act as contractors, etc., those same corporations' interests overseas will be directly defended by said military. I mean, it's really unfortunate in the United States of America that when you take an oath of office, or oath of rank, I'm not saying that correctly, oath of service as a member of the military, whatever armed force it is. You swear allegiance to uphold, protect, preserve, defend the Constitution of the United States. It has nothing to do with protecting or defending the corporate access to marketplace, resource, or profits. But unfortunately for the American soldiers, so much of what is done with their service and lives is precisely that. You know, on this Memorial Day, one can realize that with all the issues that the veterans of the most recent wars have, that seem very dissimilar to the same problems are not found with the greatest generation, with the World War II generation. Because I think there was a much clearer purpose, much clearer reality, where you can go to hell and see the fire and see the death. But when you come back, you know you have done something just, or at least everyone has decided that it was something just. You fought Nazis. You fought Japanese imperial forces, which seemed like pure evil at the time, and maybe large parts of it were. But there was a certain unity involved with that. I think while so many veterans of World War II would have had stress disorders, post-traumatic stress disorders, and other types of dissociative perspectives upon coming back into civilian life, etc., that those weren't as difficult. It wasn't the same struggle to reposition oneself back into the civilian world, because what was done in World War II in Europe and in the Pacific could have been seen as being more just, more useful, more necessary. Not the same for Vietnam, not the same for Iraq, not the same at all. And I think the veterans and the issues that they deal with prove that. That Operation Iraqi Freedom had nothing to do with our freedom, and it certainly had nothing to do with the non-existent Iraqi freedom. I mean, freedom to what? To fight endless internecine civil conflict without the threat of Saddam Hussein. Spraying your town with various chemicals or poisons. On this Memorial Day, as we remember, the purpose of Memorial Day is to remember the American soldier. I mean, Veterans Day is about World War I. Memorial Day is about the Civil War, a conflict that is still misunderstood here in America. Concepts of it are still misunderstood. It many times gets simply boiled down to an issue of slavery, an issue of freedom. One of the original sins of the United States, slavery. There are several original sins of the United States. One of them, most certainly, slavery. And the Civil War being the termination of chattel slavery, not the termination necessarily of the original sin. We're still dealing with that. We're so close to those folks. So close. I don't care what Kareem Abdul-Jabbar said, and I don't care what crusty old kind of NBA guys from the West Coast know about that whatsoever. Hardly matters whatsoever. The Memorial Day that we celebrate today, I'm not sure what it's truly about. To be perfectly honest with you, I'm not sure what it's truly about. Are we supposed to Is it a mattress sale? What is that? That's President's Day. I mean, it's what is the sale? What is everyone going? Is it a good weekend to buy a car? Is that what's going on? I mean, what fundamentally is this about? Should we eat short ribs and drink 30 beers? Is that what this holiday is about? Nobody knows what this holiday is about. Because this holiday, folks, is about a disassociation of conflict and the reality of the American experience, where America is not made safe by our military, not preserving, protecting, and defending the Constitution, and essentially going to bat for corporations. America is made safe by the fact that the whole world lives in America, and everyone is here, that no other country has an immigrant policy even close to what the United States has. That's what makes America safe. Because everyone is here. Strength in numbers. It's inspiration. It's possibility. And there is so much of that. That 12 minutes before the top of the hour, I'm Benjamin, your host of the show. I'll be right back with you after these messages and these frequencies here on the Paragon Radio Program.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. On Saturday, June 14th at IBEW Local 124, the Heartland Labor Forum will celebrate 25 years of talking back to the boss with two of our favorite hellraisers, America's number one populist Jim Hightower and labor troubadour Ann Feeney. We'll have a VIP meet and greet dinner at 6 p.m., followed by a hell-raising speech and concert at 7. Details, advance tickets, and directions are available at kkfi.org. We
do. Take me Lake Charles, I can win $100. Buy some milk and mashed potatoes. Maybe buy you some flowers. I lost my license when Rita came ashore. Trying to help my sister, I dropped it on the floor. So take me to Lake Charles. Bones. I'll have to change my name to Savings and Loan. Nickel to my name, my cousin come and get me in a drizzle and rain. Target the free. So take me to Lake Charles. 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 Take me to Lake Charles.
7 minutes for the hour of one right here on the Paragon Radio Program. I'm Benjamin, your host. 816-931-5534. 816-301-5731 is the non-corporately sponsored Paragon Radio text line. And 816-931-5534 is the phone number to the on-air studio. You could also email paragonradio@gmail.com. Go to the blog, paragonradio.blogspot.com, or the archive and Jake's website. Go find the others.com. Lots of information out there for you to obtain and synthesize and do something productive with. At least you could. You could do that. Or you could just go on to Pornstagram and look at uploaded pictures of people's genitals. There's two ways the internet can go. Or you could go to Amazon and order a bunch of stuff with two-day shipping. I guess it's a three-way. You could use the internet to educate and liberate your mind, or fill it with filthy pictures, or buy stuff from a warehouse somewhere in Chanute, or wherever the Amazon warehouse is. Amazon warehouse, of course, full of people high on methamphetamines running back and forth, filling orders. I mean, that's got to be what if you're in rural wherever, and it's an Amazon warehouse, which are massive. They're, you know, the size of multiple football fields, and they have shelves to the very high ceilings. And just toothless tweakers running back and forth, filling your order for all your mindless goods. Toothbrushes and speed stick and whatever you buy with your two-day shipping off of the Amazon Prime. I wanted to buy a book, a brand new book. They still make those, folks, in case you didn't know. I wanted to buy a brand new book. And a lot of times I buy my new books at that large club store over on Linwood that treats their employees pretty well, so you don't have to feel too bad about buying from a large club store. Which, you know, growing up in the inner city was always a challenge to buy anything. I mean, certainly there are liquor stores and grocery stores in Midtown, but there are very few clothing stores that you can shop at affordably, or at least there were department style stores. Certainly go to the boutiques, go buy $100 jeans. But you always kind of struggled with those kinds of things, and it's not like it has changed. So much of what you have to purchase, you still have to drive far away, go far outside of Midtown to get. But I wanted to get that new book about the Koch brothers, Sons of Wichita, which I did get. By the way, I did get that book. I have not been able to start reading it, though. My weekend was too full. Very fascinated by the Koch brothers, as most people are. 5 years ago, nobody knew who these people were. And we're just now starting to understand the full scope of what changes they have done to the American political landscape. I just kind of wanted to understand the psychology of them all. But what I wanted to do is I wanted to buy this, you know, book that's done by somebody from Mother Jones, exposing the modern-day American political power structure. It's like, I should probably buy that from, you know, like a real bookstore and pay full price for it, right? So I could support that level of journalism, that level of information gathering. Well, where is the independent bookstore in Kansas City? Yeah, where can you go buy a new book at an independent bookstore in Kansas City? There are two independent bookstores left in all of Kansas City.
Kansas City actually has got quite a bit of bookstores compared to most other towns.
New Line Bookstores. Go buy a brand new book. Do you know where the new bookstore is?
on the plaza.
No, no, independent. Barnes & Noble is not an independent bookstore.
On Shawnee Mission Parkway.
Correct. Rainy Day Books would be the one independent bookstore. For New Line Books. Oh, actually, there's one of two. Do you know what the other independent bookstore is in Kansas City that sells new books? The Reading Reptile. It's for children.
I haven't been there.
One out of the two independent bookstores. And the Reading Reptile, I'll say it, it's amazing. The place is awesome. Rainy Day Books is pretty cool, too. It's kind of like, Rainy Day Books is kind of the place where you'd put on a sweater. Go to drink some herbal tea and look for a book on poetry or something like that. It's a good place for a sweet-smelling gentleman with a mustache to go, wearing a fluorescently colored sweater. Just have, a nice afternoon talking about his feelings to strangers. It's a simple place. It's in Fairway.
Might get pulled over on the way there.
Yeah, no, you might get pulled over. Absolutely. I recommend walking or riding your bike. Less likely to get harassed by the local law enforcement. There's no question about that. But there's something to be said for that. There was a time in which, that bookstore in the plaza, Barnes & Noble, had a huge music selection in its basement. That's all gone now. They have a bunch of, $5 CDs left. Because you can't just go buy CDs anymore.
Well, it depends. The Barnes & Noble's on the plaza definitely has, it must be somebody who works in the music department, but they have a heavy emphasis on their world department. They get all the new hot.
If you go to a place like that, nowadays, all that stuff's being phased out. And then eventually, bookstores will be phased out. Barnes & Noble's already closing a whole bunch of stores. Borders is out of business. These bookstores that killed the independent bookstores are now dying themselves because of, Amazon or something like that. It's 1 o'clock in the morning right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI Kansas City. Kansas City community radio in the 21st century. And that's why good, let them die.
Well, it's just like everything else. In my town, Hollywood Video moved in and they put 7 video stores.